Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jill Robinson. Jill has been a pioneer of animal welfare in Asia since 1985, widely recognized as the world's leading expert on the bear bile industry, having campaigned against it since 1993. UK-born, Jill arrived in Hong Kong in 1985 and spent 12 years working for the International Fund for Animal Welfare. She founded Dr. Dog in 1991, the first animal therapy program in Asia. More than 1,000 dogs have since qualified as therapists, visiting hospitals, disabled centers, schools, and elderly homes in cities across Asia. In 1993, a visit to a bear farm in China defined Jill's future, exposing the plight of endangered Asiatic black bears cruelly farmed for bile extraction. Jill embarked on a journey to end the practice. In 1998, she founded Animals Asia, an organization devoted to ending bear bile farming in China and Vietnam and bring about long-term change for animals by promoting compassion and respect. Today, Animals Asia has rescued over 600 bears, caring for them at its award-winning bear sanctuaries in China and Vietnam, and has signed a formal agreement with the Vietnam government to end bear bile farming by 2022. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be talking with you. Thank you.
So let's start. What is bear bile farming?
Well, it's a practice that has been really going on since the early 1980s. It now involves thousands of bears in China and in Vietnam, where bears are housed in tiny wire cages and milked, as they call it. Or, you know, that's a very sort of, cozy word, if you like, for it, but they have their bile extracted from their gallbladders that is used in traditional medicine. And this was something that I first became aware of in the early 1990s. And one of the main reasons, of course, that I set up the foundation Animals Asia to address it and hopefully to end it in Asia.
So what's the scope of this, like how many bears are held, how many different facilities probably, and is it only in quotes the two countries, China and Vietnam, or is it other countries as well?
No, there's other countries. So there's Laos and Myanmar, South Korea, but they have bears in quite minimal quantities on bear bile farms, but nevertheless, it's still a problem in those countries. The main areas where bear farming occurs, of course, again, is Vietnam and China. But happily, in Vietnam, it is now an illegal practice, and we're well on the way to ending it finally, as you already said earlier, by 2022. Thousands and thousands of bears are still existing in China, where it is a legal industry, sadly. And, there are great approaches by the government there to help to protect bears, but still a long way to go until bear farming actually ends in that country as well.
And what species are we talking about?
Well, in China, we're predominantly talking Asiatic black bears, actually in both countries, Asiatic black bears or moon bears because of the beautiful yellow crescent on their chests. But also in China, brown bears are also farmed. And in Vietnam, there are some sun bears as well that are also implicated in the trade. But again, across the bear farming industry, it's mainly the species of moon bears or Asiatic black bears.
And in the introduction, we've said that these are endangered. And so before we talk about them being endangered, can you talk about the traditional range of Asiatic black bears? And I know bears here very well, and I've interviewed people about grizzly bears, but I don't know anything about Asiatic black bears. So can you introduce us and help us sort of fall in love with Asiatic black bears?
Absolutely, Derek. They're a remarkable species, and their range is, you know, pretty much all across the Asia continent, you know, from India, Pakistan, China, of course, Vietnam, Russia, Thailand. Their range is wide, but again, they are an appendix one endangered species. So this is not just an animal welfare issue, of course, it's a conservation issue too, because sadly, many of the farms will use the bears from the wild. They'll trap bears illegally from the wild to supplement the farms. So, you know, we hope in conservation terms that governments recognise more and more that unless they are seriously protected now and prevented from entering the bear farming trade, there's every indication that we will lose them. And also, of course, the fact that this implicates not just Asiatic black bears in Asia, but it implicates other bears as well, because once you see, you know, demand, you obviously have other species of bears that are caught up in the industry too. So even, you know, in your neck of the woods in the USA, you have people coming over from Asia and encouraging the killing of these, of your own bears, you know, black bears and brown bears, so that their whole gallbladders can be used in the trade as well.
Well, that was something I didn't know if I was going to mention in the interview or not, but back in 2004, someone wrote me from Canada to say that maybe 10 years previous, she had seen grizzly bears as often as I see black bears here, that she had seen them every single day, and that in the previous couple years, she'd only seen maybe 3 or 4 total, and that was because bear hunters had discovered the market.
Yeah, it's very sad. You hear wildlife officers in the US saying that they discover the carcasses of bears missing just the gallbladders and the paws. And obviously that's critical in terms of how we look at this whole industry and how we can, you know, work to bring it to an end, knowing, of course, that there are many, many alternatives to take the place of bear bile, and indeed whole, you know, the gallbladders too.
Well, I wanted to ask you, what are the lives of the Asiatic black bears like in the wild? But this is actually a really good segue. We can come back to that if we want. What's the purpose of, from the perspective of those who use it, what is the purpose of bear bile? Why is this even a market?
Well, I think your listeners will be very, very surprised to hear that bear bile works. And this was something, of course, when I was first investigating the industry way back in the early 1990s, I was prepared, like many of your listeners maybe now, to write it off as some sort of quack medicine. But I got a very short, sharp shock when I started to talk with traditional medicine doctors, of course, in China and in Vietnam, and, you know, recognize that there's been a history of thousands of years for the use of bear bile. You know, before bear bile began, bears were killed in the wild for their whole gallbladders. And then bear bile farming began in the early 80s, to ostensibly, extract the bile for use in traditional medicine. And, you know, I very quickly learned that bear bile is termed as a cold medicine to treat heat-related illnesses such as high fevers and temperatures, red and sore eyes, chronic liver complaints, even things like hemorrhoids. Wherever there is inflammation, bear bile will be used as an antidote to that, if you like. You know, if we look at sort of yin-yang, culturally, it's, you know, a cold medicine to treat heat-related illnesses. And then, you know, I went on further exploring its usage and found that since about the 1950s, the essential acid of bear bile is called urso deoxycholic acid, or UDCA. And since the 50s, this UDCA has been synthesized chemically in laboratories across the world. So it's not using bear bile, but again, it's created in a laboratory, where tons and tons of it now is being used across the world, to treat things like gallstones, chronic liver complaints again. And I think that would be a surprise to your listeners to know that, you know, anyone that is taking something called UDCA, in the States will be taking, a synthetic alternative to bear bile.
And so from the sound of it, this practice, the use of bear bile in medicine goes back a long time. This is not a modern concoction at all.
No, absolutely not. It goes back thousands of years, as I say. But it always historically has been used in China, especially for, you know, in very small quantities for very specific illnesses. It's never been used at the level that it's being used today, you know, for anything from headaches to hemorrhoids. And I think, you know, that again is when we talk with traditional medicine practitioners in Asia, you know, they say that their whole remit is healing without harm, which is very reassuring. You know, obviously there are doctors that still do use bare bile, but there are many more ethical doctors, I would have to say, that look at the conservation of these animals, look at the threat to them in the wild, look at the cruelty to them on the bare bile farms, and say that, you know, that the use of bare bile isn't within the discipline, again, of healing without harm.
I'm guessing also, and this is just a guess, that if we talk 1,500 years ago or 2,000 years ago, the use of it would probably have been, I mean, it would not have been worthwhile to do the, probably at that point, pretty difficult process of killing a bear just for the gallbladder. I'm sure at that point that they used the fur, they used the meat, they used everything.
Exactly, and they have done as well for millennia. You know, again, the paws, have, as you know, have probably read, have been used in bear paw soup. The meat and the fat have been used. I mean, yes, of course, the whole parts of the bears. But, you know, and I think, you know, to be fair, you know, China introduced bear farming in the early 1980s to try to mitigate the loss in the wild of so many bears being killed. But I think, you know, that really has seen over the years bear farmers that are in fact seeing the bears that they have dying on the bear bile farms and then using the wild species to supplement the numbers of bears that have then, you know, lost their lives on the bear bile farms.
So whenever I've read about bear bile farming or whenever I've seen pictures, it looks pretty it looks like a very painful and not a very, it's very much understatement, not a very happy life for the bear. Yes. Don't they have to keep basically an open wound sticking into the gallbladder? I mean, how does it all work?
They do. I mean, obviously to get bile from the gallbladder of an animal, it would be the same as us. You have to go in surgically to those animals. And so there are various practices that are used in Asia, from, you know, either anesthetizing the bear with crude anesthetics and going in with an ultrasound to locate the position of the gallbladder. Once located, then a 4-inch spinal needle will be used to stab down and until they're sure that the gallbladder has been reached. And then they will take the needle out of the sheath. They will actually lick it to determine if they've reached the bile, because bile is a very bitter tasting fluid. Once satisfied, they'll then put a mechanical pump and draw out the bile from the gallbladder while the bear is under anesthetic. But I say very crudely, again, under anesthetic, and there is still some consciousness to this surgery, or sorry, to this procedure. And of course, the constant stabbing of the gallbladder is not doing that animal any good at all, and is providing, you know, concerns in the future of bile leakage and, you know, gallbladder pathology. I mean, the whole nine yards, it's very distasteful. Other practices, of course, then see, surgically going into that bear and, creating a fistula or a hole that is, then kept open the entire time so that bile can be extracted every day. So it's called a free drip, and it allows, as it says, the bile to freely drip out of that hole that is constantly trying to heal day on day, but which isn't allowed to. And again, that sees, you know, consequences with bile leakage into the abdomen. And, you know, any doctor listening to this will know the consequences of that as well. Obviously things like septicemia and peritonitis. You know, but there are a whole host of other issues. Of course, keeping a bear in a cage, an animal that is wild by nature, psychologically, that does great harm to these animals. So we have to deal with the consequences of that. When they arrive with us at the sanctuaries, again, as you've said, we've rescued over 600 bears. When they arrive with us, we need to deal with things like heart conditions because of the stress of being on these farms and being extracted as they are. We have to deal with eye problems. That, again, is involved with the stress, but also with the fact of banging their heads against the bars of the cage and seeing things like lens luxations, damage to their eyes. And of course, damage where the bacteria comes from the area of bile extraction, travels up to their eyes and damages them. So we have, you know, bears with eye problems that we have to deal with, very often having to remove their eyes. We've got quite a substantial number of blind bears at our sanctuaries. And the list really does go on. But again, it's remarkable to see how incredibly stoic these animals are, and how they recover from these problems and go on to live reasonably happy and healthy lives. I will say that whenever a bear dies, they will in most all cases die as a consequence of bear bar farming at the end of their lives.
My mom died 15, 16 months ago from gallbladder / biliary duct / pancreatic cancer. And before she was dying, she was talking about how incredibly painful it was. And everybody I know who has had anything associated with gallbladders, anything go wrong, has talked about pretty extreme pain. So I'm guessing that this process is also, even though they may be under anesthetic during it, if it's not the drip sort, I'm guessing that it's, and even if we drop off holding them in captivity and everything else, this seems to me that this process has to be remarkably painful as well.
I'm so sorry for your mum. I'm so sorry, Derek. I mean, it, as you say, it is the most painful thing. Anyone listening now with even a rice-sized gallstone in their gallbladder will attest to that. And we believe that's no different for the bears as well. And again, it's just another very good reason why we should be looking at the alternatives, both synthetic and herbal, and recognizing that they can do the job equally efficiently and remarkably as bear bile, and start to, you know, wind down this industry and allow the bears their time in the wild. There is no way, I will go on record, there is no way that you can extract bile humanely from a bear. No way. And, you know, as you say, while they may have anesthetic to actually perform the initial surgery, they still go on to have to live with the consequences of daily milking of their bile each and every day, and the daily consequences of the rapidly growing infection and contaminants that they see within their gallbladders and bile as the days and weeks and years go on.
Are most of the facilities, what is, I don't know if you can answer this, but what is ownership of the facilities? Are these owned by huge companies, or is this something that there's a backyard farmer has two bears in his shed? How does it work economically?
Yeah, absolutely. It's both. Vietnam, very often it's they're usually sort of smaller operations. You know, maybe anything up to about 100 bears.
That's small. Is 100?
Yeah. In China, they have very large farms that can be into the thousands of bears. So it's very different practices and very different ownerships. And again, it's both countries. You can have the sort of the smaller models where there's just a couple of bears, where people are keeping them sort of as a backyard operation amongst other species that they're raising. You know, for example, deers or even domestic livestock like pigs, for example, and chickens as well.
And how big, if you can say, how big would be average the average cage be? How much space does the bear have to move around?
In some cases, you know, the bears can stand up quite comfortably in cages, maybe of about, you know, six feet square or something. In other cases, they are literally kept in coffin-sized cages, which will indeed become their coffins at the end of their lives.
And just so everybody's clear, I know grizzly bears can have a 20 square mile range or something like that, and black bears here might have 10 square miles, have at least, I mean, at the very least, a mile or two.
Yeah.
So what would be a typical, and one reason I think about this is because I wrote a book about zoos, and there was to open the book, before I went to the book, I mean, before I wrote the book, I had to go to a zoo. And there was a grizzly bear who was pacing three steps one direction, yeah, tossing his head, two steps left, toss its head three steps and basically a little square. And so I was just thinking about, you know, it had an effective it can walk in that square area as opposed to in the wild, it walks literally miles. So what would the life be like for these bears in the wild? Not at the sanctuary. We'll get there. But what is life like for wild bears in those bears?
As you say, exactly that. You know, they have the freedom of many, many miles to roam throughout the day. You know, bears are opportunists, so they're spending a large part of their time out there in the forests, you know, searching for food, and, you know, just are keeping away from humans as much as they can, predominantly too. And, you know, that again is obviously an extremely important point that you've raised, because their habitat is being, you know, consistently shrunk, throughout this time, and trapping them and snaring them for the farms has obviously become much easier, because they are encroaching more onto human land, because their forest is being, you know, taken away from them, and their selection of food is becoming less and less. So they're automatically turning into farmland as well. So this is another big, big problem that needs to be addressed by the governments of the countries if they really want to take a serious effort in conserving their Appendix 1 species of bears. And again, we offer our help to both China and Vietnam in that respect. You know, we've helped to fund population studies, for example, of these animals. And we're very keen on looking at the conservation issues as well as, of course, the welfare issues surrounding bear bar farming and its practices.
What percentage of the bears are wild caught and what percent are raised in captivity?
In Vietnam, all wild caught. We've not had one farm that has demonstrated any ability to breed on the farms at all, ever. And that's also consistently demonstrated by the fact that we are seeing bears when we rescue them missing limbs from being caught in the wild in leg hole traps or snares. In China, they do have a better success rate of breeding, especially on some of the super farms as well. But again, we do have three-legged bears there, so we know that some of the farmers are, again, supplementing their bears by those that are wild caught.
You know, I know that I mentioned before that I see bears here all the time, and for the most part, they're not particularly social. They will sometimes hang out, but not generally. So how does that whole captive breeding work anyway? Because, again, they don't usually hang out together very much. And I know that when they do breed, I've never seen the breeding, but I've seen courtship many times where basically the female will just walk around and the male will, he'll sort of mope around behind her about 10 or 15 steps until finally she's like, okay, until the courtship is consummated. Let's just put it that way.
Yes.
And, but the courtship does take many days of wandering around.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you don't have to say this if you don't want, but how does that all work? I mean, they just put the two in a cage together. Why wouldn't they fight?
Well, we've seen denning areas at some of these farms. As I said, especially some of the super farms. So they do have denning areas, and recognizing, of course, that the bears are hormonally charged. You know, at the time when the females come into season, obviously that they'll be put into the denning areas, to mate, and considering that there's really not much else to do in their lives, you know, I think that, you know, that is obviously, where success, occurs on the bear bar farms. But I think, again, you know, when you've got bears in very, very small, unless you've got them in those sort of denning areas, appropriate for mating, yes, you're not going to see them, particularly inclined to want to mate as well. And that's why I think they've had no success in Vietnam, because they just sort of shove them in a cage. And I think, but more often than not, fights break out, and I think they probably see more mortalities than any success in mating.
So my primary concern is for the bears themselves, and the bears in the wild and the bears in captivity. But when I know that for some people this is very important, that when Vietnam, for example, is shutting down the bear farming, are they providing alternative methods for the people who are doing it to raise money?
That's an interesting point. In Vietnam, again, generally, they are really mom and pop farms. So again, they've become very, very, very rich over these years. It's not quite the same in China, although there are very rich bear farmers there, of course, too. But in Vietnam, I think that, you know, once the farms close down, the biggest issue for the farmers is certainly not a lack of finance. And in any case, the Vietnam government will sometimes offer what they call rewards to the bear bar farmers if they do give up their bears. We don't offer a compensation ourselves in Vietnam because bear farming has been illegal for a long, long time. It's just that the government up until now has been turning rather a blind eye to the issue and allowing it to continue. And we don't feel that bear farmers should be rewarded for, you know, continuing on with an illegal practice. Now, in China, it's a little bit different. Historically, when we've rescued those bears, we have provided compensation for the farmers ourselves. Because it is a legal industry and we didn't want to see the bear farmers suffering as a result of our practices. As unpalatable as we recognize the bear farming industry is, we don't want to become enemies of the people as well. And we want to try to, you know, show, you know, respect to people whose livelihoods would be severely affected by our actions once the farms close down. So again, we have been providing compensation. Obviously, this is ongoing discussions now with the Chinese government. You know, our role is just to try to offer as much help as we can to protect these bears, to protect bears in the wild, to do whatever we can to work collaboratively with the Chinese government to ensure that the species of Asiatic black bears is protected, you know, way into the future. So there's lots of different conversations, as you can imagine, that have been going on over these years. But our role is not to sort of look back and criticize and point the fingers. It's to look forward and try to work together as collaboratively as we can to solve a problem that has been going on for many, many years. And I'm really pleased to see that we are doing exactly that in Vietnam, where we've signed an official MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, with the Vietnam government, and we look really set to end bear bar farming there together with other NGOs by the year 2022.
So I'm going to ask you in a moment about rescuing, and so let's leave that aside for a moment. Apart from rescuing, how does the process actually work to improve? What do you do and what does Animals Asia do to help with both the animal welfare and to end this? Are we talking about lobbying? Are we talking about talking to sort of general work of talking to people like the public, Again, leaving off rescuing and sanctuaries for a moment, what do you do?
Okay. Vietnam is a really good example of a success story, I think, over these years. And this has been obviously quietly lobbying with the Vietnam government, working with schools and universities, working on public education programs across the country, engaging the help of traditional medicine doctors. In Vietnam, there's a very large organization of traditional medicine practitioners, some 60,000 to 70,000 members in that country. And Tuan Ben Dixon, our Vietnam director, and our team there have been working very, very closely with these doctors in winding down the prescription and the sale of bear bile. And in fact, by the end of this year, we've got the whole traditional medicine organization to agree not to prescribe or sell bile at all, and to replace it with the 32 herbs that are available instead. We've got booklets that we've produced in English and Vietnamese to show the community the herbal alternatives that exist. We have monthly clinical sessions where the local communities can come along to see traditional medicine doctors and talk about their past habits of using bear bile and understand from the doctors today about how the herbal alternatives are equally, or if not better than bear bile. You know, at some of these clinics, the public are encouraged to bring their children because they're usually at a weekend. So obviously the children aren't at school. So they come along and they are entertained by our team who are providing sort of painting booklets and drawing competitions and just to keep the children amused. It's usually the elderly that are going along to these clinics. And, you know, when they go back to their villages, the elderly are very much revered in these same villages and are listened to when they talk about the medicine that they've just brought back that contains only herbs and not bears and how important it is to conserve the bears in the wild. We work with the foreign embassies very extensively in Vietnam as well. Again, quietly lobbying them, encouraging them to encourage the Vietnamese government to bring the practice to an end, and all on a very sort of sensitive and very collaborative approach type way. That doesn't see humiliation to the country. No one wants to be told what to do. No one wants to be humiliated. And again, this has always been the method of Animals Asia to, again, try and end a practice where we get the buy-in of everybody to do that so that, you know, everybody wins, the government, the local community, the farmers, and, of course, the bears themselves as well.
So I'm going to tell two quick stories. One of them is in the United States. In the Western, I grew up in the whole Western United States, and there is among many Westerners a real hatred of, for example, wolves. And so people who defend wolves have a very difficult time with sort of the general public. And on the other hand, I interviewed a person by the name of Ram Whitaker last year who works on snake bites, and he loves cobras, and he works on cobra snake bites in India. And I asked him about this, if he has the trouble that they have in the United States in the West with wolves, that people not liking them. He said, no, people love cobras. So my main work, even though there's, I think, 50,000 people die every year in India from cobra bites, and he said, people love cobras, so mainly I just have to educate them to wear, like, rubber boots when they go walking in cobra territory. And so my question is, do you face a real uphill struggle with the populace, not the healers and not the farmers, but the general people? Do they generally like the bears, or do they kind of dislike the bears, or do they not care about the bears? And I realize we're talking about many different countries, so you have different experiences. Was it a hard sell, or was it an easy sell? Is that what I'm kind of getting at?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Derek. And there's, again, a lot of public education programs that we run to try to create sympathy for living harmoniously with bears in the wild. You know, you've got, again, as I said earlier, where bears are encroaching onto human habitat, which is ironic because that human habitat was, of course, once bear habitat. And it's important to, you know, not see bears as the enemy here. And obviously where they do encroach on farmland as well, this is where you've got problems of human-bear conflict. And it's another one of the areas that we're addressing, especially in China, where we're working in Yunnan province with local biologists there to try to understand the problems of bears coming in and killing livestock, for example, and perhaps even hurting people if they're coming too far into human-habited areas. So, you know, we've supplied things like uniforms to local rangers and camera traps so that they can, first of all, understand the extent of the problem. And then once we have the results in from these studies, then we obviously want to work with those biologists and with local government officials in how to mitigate those problems too. So it's a very sort of, organic area, if you like, that we're addressing. It's not just from the fact of rescuing bears, but it's also helping people to understand more sympathetically the lives of these bears in the wild and how they can protect themselves from them, if they're taking too much of the habitat away of these bears.
And generally, is that, I guess I wasn't quite clear, and thank you for saying all that. I wasn't quite clear. Is there a history of sort of bear adversity, or is there a history of, oh, we kind of like them? I mean, what's traditional?
It just depends. It depends where you are. You know, it's a funny one. You know, in China, I heard a story quite recently that if children are naughty, parents will say, you know, you better behave or the bear will get you. You know, so, but again, you know, the more public education programs that we run in schools, we find that there's a great deal of public sympathy as well for the bears, and also indeed for conserving them. You know, I think people recognize that our habits now are to the extent where we are really dangerous to a whole host of species and the natural world. And that if we don't shape up, we're going to lose these incredible megafauna. So you know, it's very different depending on who you speak with. You know, some people are for bears, some people are against them. But I think again that the onus is on us and lots of NGOs like us to be going out there and creating more sympathy so we can live harmoniously, you know, with other species.
So a basic question I haven't asked is, how big are they? Like the black bears here, let's say a big one's probably 400 pounds.
Yeah.
That'd be 180 kilograms, I guess. Something like that. How big are these bears?
About the same. Perhaps a little smaller, the Asiatic black bears. They can run. The very small females can be about 50, 60 kilos when they're fully grown, but that's quite rare. And we've got a lot of what we call stunted bears, you know, that obviously have been in cage confinement for many years. So, we call them little munchkins because they've just got little legs and, but in the wild, of course, yes, again, pretty much the same as the American bears.
What about the sun bears? You mentioned those, but haven't talked about them. How big are they?
Much smaller, but very often twice as feisty. that's what we certainly find, having rescued both species in Vietnam. We can't obviously integrate them together, even though the sun bears are about half the size. You'd think that the Asiatic black bears have the edge, the moon bears have the edge, but they don't because sun bears are so. Their characters are huge, I have to say, and they're pretty much not frightened of anything.
And are those the only two bears that species you work with?
Oh, and brown bears in China as well.
Grizzly bears? I don't know what that means.
Yes, the equivalent of grizzly bears, exactly. Yep. And also Tibetan brown bears, which are absolutely glorious in their colors. They have a range of coppers and golds and bronzes, and they're just glorious color conformation of their fur is beautiful to see. So we're very privileged to be working with different bear species and understanding them, because my goodness, they are very, very different too. And in fact, brown bears are not legally allowed to be farmed in China anyway, but you know, we have rescued some from the bear industry there, and again, absolutely astonished by the depth of their characters and their personalities as well. And again, very different to working with moon bears.
And, you know, I've experienced this here with just the bears I see outside, that even among the same species, obviously bears have as different personalities as your personality is from me or mine is from anybody else's.
100%. 100%. You're right. Every moon bear, every sun bear that we rescue is different from the next one we will rescue or the last one that we did rescue. And that's, you know, part of the management of these incredible animals. You know, we've grown up a lot since we've begun first rescuing them in the 90s, before even Animals Asia was formed. You know, I was working before with the International Fund for Animal Welfare when we first start rescuing bears. And my gosh, our learning curve has been absolutely vertical since then. And you never completely learn everything about the bears. We always laugh that we learn new things every day about them. And they're quite the most incredible animal to work with, I have to say.
So how does a rescue take place? So tell me about rescues and tell me about about their conditions once they get to a sanctuary.
Okay, well, so I'll maybe talk from the position of Vietnam, where, you know, we're given the heads up by the government that they would like us to rescue a bear. And obviously the preparation of our team is huge, because we really don't know what we're going to find. And even though we're sent pictures from the bear farm, we don't take any chances, and we just take everything that we're going to need, you know, for a full blown rescue, whether that means anesthetizing the bear, which we prefer not to do in the field, obviously, because of all the safety reasons that we don't have a fully operational surgery set up out in the field. But we have to be prepared that we do sometimes have to anesthetize the bears to get them out of their cages. We just don't know again what we're going to see. So when we arrive at the farm, the first thing is just to literally do nothing except look at the bears and just understand what has been going on. Talk to the farmer, talk about their diet, talk about when he last extracted bile from the bears, talk about his method of bile extraction. You know, try to understand a little bit more about the personality of the bear, try to understand if there's been any sickness of the bear, and just look at that bear physically to see, you know, is there any, you know, does the bear have all four limbs? What are the tooth conditions like if we can feed them and just try to see inside the mouth? Is that bear blind? Is there any trauma in terms of the body connected with bile extraction, for example, just to get a full picture? How is the cage? How is the robustness of the cage? Is it falling apart? Is it safe? Do we have to wire it up to make sure that, you know, if we start, you know, wanting to anesthetize the bear, is it going to go crazy and start, you know, working on a cage that is not safe and is going to see our staff implicated and perhaps hurt? You know, the whole range of things. How are we going to get that bear out of the cage? Can we do that without anesthetic? Can we hook up one of our transport cages to the current bear cage and have that bear walk through into our cage without, again, having to anesthetize? So it's huge, and I really pay tribute to our staff that do it seamlessly, absolutely seamlessly. Anyone that please goes onto our Facebook page of Animals Asia, you can see the rescues live. You can see what we're doing, and you can see some of the issues. You know, we don't try to hide anything. You can see the bears sometimes going absolutely crazy because the presence of human beings means one thing. It means the painful extraction of their bile, and they know that, and they know what the presence of people means. So, you know, the last rescue that we did of three bears, Van, Alice and James, you saw the bears getting, you know, traumatized, getting very stressed. And it was a fine line between whether, you know, our vet Sean would step in and anesthetize, or whether we could just get those bears safely into recovery cages, which we did indeed do, and managed to get them on the road back to our sanctuary safely, where we could perform proper health checks on those animals under proper surgical conditions. So again, no rescue is the same. No bear is the same. No rescue is the same. Everything is different. But, you know, maximum safety is the priority of the day, both for bears and our staff, of course, at the same time.
So the bears, so I take it that when you get three bears like that, are they in the back of a big pickup, or how does that work?
Yeah, we have trucks, obviously, that bring in the empty cages, the recovery cages, so that once we've got the bears back in those cages, we can just get them on the truck and back to base as quickly and efficiently as we can.
Okay, so now you get them to base, and you look at the you presumably anesthetize them at that point to check their teeth and to check everything else?
No, absolutely not. No, unless we're really worried about the bears, health wise, we leave them alone. We put them into quarantine in their cages. We let them settle down. We let them calm down overnight. We obviously provide them with fresh food, and we check the next morning whether that has, you know, has been eaten. We're already looking at them when they come in to the sanctuary to see if, you know, how their eating is. When you've got a bear that's refusing food, you immediately start getting worried, unlike dogs and cats that sort of go without food for several days without, you know, as long as they're rehydrated and drinking water, you necessarily don't have to be worried. Very often with a bear, you know, their driving passion is food. So if you're offering them fresh watermelon or something on the end of a sort of skewer stick to be safe, to keep our staff at a safe distance from these bears, if you've got a bear that is refusing food, immediately that's noted as a point of concern. So the next morning is very indicative of whether we've got a sick bear on our hands or whether we've got a bear that is just simply stressed, but at least eating okay. And then it's just observation over the next few days. You know, unless we're really worried about any specific areas of health, there's no reason to go into a health check, but just to make sure that they are as healthy as possible for the anesthetic for that health check. So the best thing is just to leave them alone and just do constant observations. Obviously, we provide free access to food and water the whole time. We're now starting to put straw into the recovery cages so they have something soft to lie on. We're giving them toys. We're giving them enrichment throughout the day. Our team, again, are just amazing. If you go onto Facebook, you'll see Sarah there talking every day about how she's making the lives of those bears happier already, how they're turning around, like giving them showers, for example, a very simple thing that they've probably never had on a bear bar farm. But just to see James, for example, the boy, as he's just turning somersaults and going, and we call them doing zoomies. He's going crazy in his recovery cage with the delight of having a shower for the first time. He's becoming curious, creative even. He's looking at how to get enrichment into his cage. We don't always make it easy for them. So you put the toys on top of the cage bars that they have to, you know, use their ingenuity to get those toys into the cage so they can play with them. The browse we put, the banana leaves, etc., that we put on top of the cage, they have to figure out how to get that through, how to, you know, and then they'll start either eating it, playing with it, or lying on it as a soft bed. It's just wonderful to see how every single day how their characters and their personalities change from the aggressive animals that we saw, quite rightly so, on the Bear Bar farm, to an animal that he's really beginning to learn to trust again for the first time in his or her life.
And then what happens in the process after that?
And then, okay, after that, so they're in quarantine for 45 days, and then we can start to put them into den areas. Very slowly, we can start putting outside into the enclosures. We can start very carefully and very slowly integrating with the other bears, which takes a long, long time and a lot of consideration to do. You've got to really assess the characters, again, individually, of every single bear. And we have, you know, in each of our enclosures in Vietnam, where we have nearly 200 bears there, we have enclosures of anything up to, I think, 24 bears now at a time. And we've got a friendly list. So, you know, the friendliest bears obviously get introduced to the new bears first of all, so that confidence can be built up until you get finally to the bear that, you know, that we know can be a little bit grumpy on occasions. And by then, the new bear being integrated has built up a reasonable level of confidence, so that if there's a little bit of grumpiness, you know, they can sort of deal with that in their own time. And then finally, they're out in the enclosures. As you said earlier on, Derek, this is not, you know, typically a social species, but in a sanctuary situation, we find the most incredible friendships that do emerge, lifelong friendships that emerge. You know, the boys will, you know, play up with each other in certain groups. They'll sometimes at night, you know, males and females or whatever, we'll get together in the same beds. Sometimes three bears in one bed will sleep overnight, especially if the weather is colder as well. So it's a long process, but it's a very satisfying process that at the end of the day, you see a wonderfully harmonious group of literally dozens of bears together.
You know, and this is beyond the scope of this interview, but, I am not entirely convinced that bears are in fact not social, because I've read accounts of early European explorers in California talking about, quote, troops, end quote, of grizzly bears. Mm-hmm. And also I've seen bears hang out together sometimes.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I think that if there is sufficient food and sufficient calm in their lives, that bears, I have seen bears unrelated to each other sleeping together like that in the wild. And so I think that when they're happy and not stressed, I think that they can actually be somewhat social.
Yeah, you make me really smile saying that. You know, you obviously see on the salmon runs the grizzlies together. You know, when they are completely well-fed and satiated, they, of course, their driving passion is food, as we said at the beginning of this interview. And you've said something that I've said for many, many years with a smile, that I do believe there are pockets of Asiatic black bears out there socializing and playing with each other, indeed. It's a rather nice thought to think that. And I think it's sort of somewhat proven by the characteristics of our bears and how many of them do like to socialize, especially the youngsters. We call them bear bundles of play. They just roll around the enclosure together, obviously in a state of great delirious joy to be together. You know, and yes, we get others that absolutely know they don't like to be particularly social with other bears. So we acclimatize that to our sanctuaries as well. So it's all down to the bears. It's all down to what they want and what they're telling us they want and what we can do for them.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. You say the ones who don't really like to socialize is like, hi, that's me. I'm, you know, a writer. I'm basically a hermit. And then other people are extroverts. Same with bears. So you've mentioned drive for food a few times, and can you please astound and amaze people with how much these bears eat every day?
I think it's about 6 kilos. I haven't weighed it lately, but we used to weigh it. They do weigh it. I mean, but I used to, understand it was about 6 kilos, and I think that's about right. So they get two or even three main meals a day, and then they get enrichment in between. And they're just like us. They are food obsessed. They absolutely love their grub. And, you know, the challenge for our teams in both China and Vietnam is to, you know, accord to that desire, their passion for food, and make it as selective and as interesting as we can every single day. In the enclosures, it's hidden in different places every day. So the range of food is different, and changes all the time. But also the way that it's laid out in the enclosure also changes all the time. So you're not just getting it in nice neat piles for the bears to go out and find immediately that they go out of their dens. They have to, as they would in the wild, forage and look for it and search for it and be satisfied when they find it. You know, job done. We've just found this. Wow, that's a surprise. Or we've just found this under a pile of rocks or under a pile of logs or placed high up onto enclosure furniture, etc., etc. So it's not easy, even for the blind ones, for the disabled ones, the three-legged bears. And we don't make it easy because we find again that they are very, very adaptable outside in their enclosures. And if the food is out there, their keen noses will tell them where it is and they'll find it.
So we're starting to run out of time, but there's still so many questions I want to ask. So I'm going to ask a few questions real quick. One is, I've mentioned that there are bears here and I love seeing them and I love all that, but that doesn't alter the fact that they, 1 year a baby bear decided that it wanted to chew on my tires and I had to replace 3 truck tires. Some bears last year decided they wanted to rip up part of the porch. So bears can be pretty mischievous. Tell a story or two of them ripping something apart.
I don't even have to think. It happens every day, every single day. And I read in the bear reports as well when I'm not there, you know, that bears have damaged their enclosure furniture and they have to do a total recall of those bears to bring them in because some of their climbing apparatus is, you know, has nails. So once, if they destroy it, then we have to bring all the bears back in so that our team, our maintenance team, can go out there and repair and remove any dangerous nails, et cetera. We have to protect some of the trees in both sanctuaries because they are protected. The trees are protected, and of course we don't want to see all the trees being destroyed by the bears. But still, they will destroy the tree protectors sometimes and circumvent those protectors and climb up into the trees and rip all the branches for their friends below. We actually call those tree parties, where you see maybe about 10 bears under one tree, where a bear is up in that tree destroying it and the bears are getting all the benefits of the branches and leaves below. I could just go on. We have Kong toys, you know, that we give them that they will destroy as well. Everything you give them, their mission in life is frankly to destroy everything that you give them. And that's the funniest and satisfying and perhaps most expensive part of looking after them as well.
So I guess two questions. I guess we'll end here. One of them is there anything else you want to talk about? And then the other one is, how can people support your work?
I would just like people to be really inspired, I think, by the fact that, we have a really difficult job to do in both China and Vietnam, and they're both very different countries to work in. But I hope that by the pioneering aspect of ending bear bar farming in Vietnam gives everybody help that we can make change. This is one of the, you know, founding missions of Animals Asia. It's the goal for which we were founded, and we've achieved that in Vietnam. And we're so excited and so thrilled because we think that this can be a springboard example for other countries in Asia to follow. Again, where no one loses, but everybody wins. So if people like the story of what we're doing, I hope that they will please support Animals Asia. Join us for the beginning of the end now of bear bar farming in Vietnam to show how it can be done and provide an example for every other country to follow that currently engages in bear farming, which will help and not hinder those involved in the trade as well. So, to help them elegantly get out of the trade. That's what I'm trying to say. So please, thank you again. Support Animals Asia. Go onto our website, www.animalsasia.org, and be part of this mission and this goal that is going to see help for not just captive bears, but of course, bears in the wild too.
You know, that would be a beautiful place to end, but I can't help myself. I want to ask one more question, which is, you, one of the reasons that you're one of my heroes is that you saw a problem, and instead of just complaining about it, you decided to fix it. So can you just give 30 seconds of encouragement to other people, even if their issue is not bear bile farming, that if they find an issue, that they get up off their butts and fix it?
Absolutely. My whole life was changed by one bear on a bear bar farm that touched my shoulder, and I stupidly touched her paw and she didn't hurt me. But she just sent me the strongest message, and we all receive messages like that of every dimension that we can choose to listen to or ignore. So don't ignore that message in your heart. Go for whatever your heart tells you you want to do, because, you know, I was one person on my own, and I can't believe what I see now with the most incredible team and the most incredible privilege of working with these animals. Just go for it. Just do it.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jill Robinson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.